Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Roger Norman, Executive Director of the Center for Economic and Social Rights, who assesses the dangers posed by the U.S. post-war occupation of Iraq and possible new Pentagon targets in the Middle East. Robert Jensen, Professor of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, who takes a critical look at how the U.S. media has reported the Bush administration's war on Iraq. And Terry Collingsworth of the International Labor Rights Fund, who discusses the violence against union activists in Colombia and a lawsuit charging that Coca-Cola bottlers there are complicit in the attacks. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The American military is refusing to clean up any of the toxic debris from depleted uranium, or DU ammo, it used in the recent U.S. invasion of Iraq. The Pentagon is ignoring its own 1990 study that says long-term health risks from DU ammo could be an issue for civilians and combatants who inhale particles from the uranium-based weapon. Now U.S. military spokesman Lieutenant Colonel David LaPan has told the BBC that the study was outdated. He argued that other studies on DU done in Bosnia show the high-intensity ammo is not a health threat. A March 2003 study for the United Nations Environmental Program found traces of DU in air and water samples in Bosnia-Herzegovina 7 years after the fighting ended. While the UN study did not find any health effects from DU, it recommended collecting DU fragments, covering them with asphalt or clean soil, and to keep records of the contaminated sites. Gulf War veterans from America and Britain say their exposure to DU led to major medical problems. High levels of leukemia among Iraqi children have been linked by doctors to use of DU ammo by the U.S. in the 1991 Persian Gulf War. Dr. Asaf Durakovic, a former head of nuclear medicine at a U.S. veterans hospital, testified before Congress in 1997 that injury and death from depleted uranium will remain lingering threats to survivors of the battle for decades into the future. The BBC reports that the peace process in the disputed Indonesian province of Aceh is at a crisis point. In early April, monitors overseeing the peace deal signed in December were pulled out of field offices in response to violent attacks on buildings used by the so-called Joint Security Committee, or JSC, who are carrying out the agreement brokered by the Swiss-based Henri Dunant Center. Many Western observers suspect that the violence has been orchestrated by the Indonesian military. One diplomat told the Financial Times, "Elements of the security forces have taken a clear decision to disrupt the work of the JSC, to discredit the JSC, and thereby disrupt the agreement." In one incident, hundreds of protesters surrounded one field office and threatened to burn it down unless the peace monitors left. Steve Daly, a spokesman for the Henri Dunant Center, called the attacks on peace monitors deliberate and clearly organized. Prior to the attacks, the peace process had already bogged down. A demilitarization phase was due to have started in February. Rebels were supposed to turn in their weapons at specific sites under international monitoring, and the Indonesian military had agreed to redeploy its soldiers into defensive position. In reality, neither side has taken actual steps toward disarmament. Several Denver Amnesty International activists have detailed files in a secret police department database. The activists who have pushed for more police accountability are labeled criminal extremists in the database and associated with criminal organizations. Mark Cohen, one of the Denver activists targeted, noted, "None of us has ever been arrested, much less convicted of a crime for our political activities." According to Amnesty International, spying on activists by the Denver Police Department started in the McCarthy era. The department's Criminal Intelligence Bureau started a file system that grew to 100,000 records. Under pressure from a First Amendment lawsuit by the Colorado chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, a three-judge panel recommended deleting 208 groups and nearly 3,300 individuals from the police database. A 1998 intelligence memo ordered the destruction of files to avoid any future lawsuits. Similar intelligence purge orders were given to police departments in Chicago, Los Angeles, and Portland, Oregon. But the threat to civil liberties continues. Activists are especially concerned by an order from U.S. federal judge Charles Haight in New York that allows the New York Police Department to ignore criminal intent in seeking the authority to spy on political activists. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
After several weeks of fighting for control of Iraq's largest cities, the Pentagon announced on April 14th that major combat operations were over. But while the president and his administration were jubilant at the victory of the world's most powerful military over a nation battered by 12 years of economic sanctions and a decade of constant bombing, it seemed that the occupation of Iraq would be filled with danger and uncertainty. After Saddam Hussein's forces fled Baghdad, chaos and violence reigned in the streets of the capital city and elsewhere as the looting of government offices, hospitals, museums, and private homes went unchallenged by U.S. troops. But while the Pentagon made little effort to control widespread pillaging, the old regime's Ministry of Oil was one of the few government buildings to be guarded by U.S. Marines, a powerful symbol of why many believe the U.S. had come to Iraq. Anti-U.S. occupation protests were organized by Baghdad citizens just days after American tanks rolled into the central city. Islamic fundamentalist Shiites, Sunni groups, and Kurdish rebels are now in fierce competition with each other for spheres of influence and a role in any government body installed by former U.S. General Jay Garner, the man appointed by the Bush administration to run post-war Iraq. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Roger Normand, executive director of the Center for Economic and Social Rights, who assesses the dangers posed by the U.S. post-war occupation of Iraq and possible new Pentagon targets in the Middle East.
If you look at history since World War II, there have been 20 interventions by the United States military and other countries that led to regime change. Not one of them, not one, led to a democracy. This is not a good track record if your supposed claim is to bring democracy. When we look at Iraq, so Bush tells us it's about democracy, but when you actually look at what he's doing, he's putting former generals in charge of an occupation force of another country. That's not the way to bring democracy. The people that he is choosing from the Iraqi exile community are not known to be Democrats. They're in fact known to be crooks and thieves. Ahmed Shalabi, the potential new head of state after General Garner is finished with his tour of duty, is a wanted felon in Jordan for embezzling from a bank. So when you look at what the United States has actually done around the world, you see that it has not brought democracy. You know, you can win a war with overwhelming military force, but to actually maintain an occupation, this is where you get into what the British are calling the Hearts and Minds campaign. You actually have to offer some benefits to the people. And what the United States is doing, while, of course, talking a lot about humanitarian relief, the program for humanitarian relief, which is the UN Oil for Food program, the United States is telling the UN that that program has to end, that the UN should no longer be involved in the billions of dollars of Iraqi oil distributed in food, medicine, and humanitarian relief. And instead, that money should go to what the U.S. is calling reconstruction, which means money for Halliburton and other American companies to rebuild what the U.S. military has destroyed. This is not going to spread goodwill in Iraq. It's going to be viewed as blatant imperialism. It's not going to give the U.S. any kind of coalition outside of the Brits and the Australians. And even these two countries, even though they contributed militarily, are basically being shut out of the loot, if we can call it that, you know, the economic gains. So also, if we look at Afghanistan as an example where, you know, the United States and other countries promise rebuilding and we're never going to forget Afghanistan, and shortly after, it seems quite forgotten and the country is slipping into warlordism and chaos. So winning the peace is much more difficult, and I think the way the United States is heading, they're really much more interested in maintaining control of the wealth of Iraq than in winning the peace through any kind of legitimate democracy.
Roger Normand, we've heard some fairly bellicose statements come out of the White House as regards to the nation of Syria. Syria has been warned not to harbor Iraqi officials. The Bush administration also accuses Syria of having chemical weapons. Are we not seeing the beginnings of a justification for our new war against Damascus at this point?
Oh, I think clearly the ground is being laid for that. And again, it shouldn't come as a surprise because, you know, the Wolfowitzes and Cheneys and Rumsfelds, Douglas Feith, all of these people have been writing about the need to change the regime, not just in Iraq, but Syria, even Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iran, etc. So again, I think it's really important that people need to take these fundamentalists in Washington seriously. We need to read what they've said and realize that they will stop at nothing. International law does not matter. If the UN Charter says you can't fight an aggressive war, they'll fight one anyway. And if the Middle East is teeming with weapons of mass destruction, if our biggest ally Israel has more weapons of mass destruction than every other country in the region combined, well, that doesn't matter. And if you raise those facts, those are irrelevant facts. All that matters is strategically for this government, Syria makes sense as the next target because it's the weakest target. And we have a couple hundred thousand troops in the area. We're increasing the number of troops. We're going to establish bases in Iraq and elsewhere. And therefore, attacking Syria is relatively easy if you compare it to some of the other talked about targets, North Korea, Iran. So I think we should expect that this will happen. And people need to be aware of that and start opposing what's happening from the point of view of international law and human rights, because really the rule of law is the only thing that can ultimately save the people of this planet. Endless war is in nobody's interests, including Americans.
That was Roger Normand, Executive Director of the Center for Economic and Social Rights. Contact the center by calling area code 718-237-9145. Or visit the group's website at www.cesr.org. As American and British forces consolidated their control over Iraq, U.S. corporate media continued to bring the war into our living rooms. News anchors and journalists in the field were exuberant in reporting the fall of Iraq's dictator. Stage-managed images of several dozen Iraqi citizens helping Marines to tear down a statue of Saddam Hussein and waving American flags handed to them by soldiers were broadcast repeatedly. But some critics contend that American media has sanitized their coverage of the Iraq War and provided their audience with uncritical accounts of the White House chosen spin of the day. American media seem to consciously avoid much reporting on the horrifying scenes of the thousands of Iraqi civilians who flooded hospitals after being injured in the Bush administration's shock-and-awe bombing campaign. Neither did U.S. citizens see many harsh images of the hundreds of dead and rotting corpses of Iraqi civilians and soldiers killed in an illegal war condemned by a majority around the world. Coverage of a U.S. tank attack on a Baghdad hotel packed with international journalists killing three reporters was also limited and downplayed. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the book Writing Dissent, who takes a critical look at how the U.S. media has reported the Bush administration's war on Iraq.
Well, I often talk about the failure of success with the American commercial news media. The success, of course, is the phenomenal effort it takes to report from a place like Iraq. And if you look at what's coming out of Iraq, it's really quite phenomenal. Hundreds of journalists, millions of dollars in real-time reporting coming back. The technological accomplishments alone are quite staggering. The failure of success that I talk about is that, unfortunately, with all of this effort, I don't think American mainstream journalism really gives citizens the range of information, the level of context and history, and the spectrum of debate they need to really make informed decisions. That is, what we're getting is often very empty coverage. Lots of pictures, often very dramatic, very compelling, but failing the test of relevance, I think, on the whole. And here, TV, which is, of course, the primary information source for many Americans, has really, I think, failed, and failed quite profoundly, I think.
Reading accounts of foreign correspondents, reporters in Europe and Britain and many other nations, you get a whole different sense of the war, at least from my reading, of the death, the destruction, the injuries that have been triggered by the U.S. invasion of Iraq. That doesn't seem to come across very well in the reporting that we get primarily on television here.
Yeah, and that's one where the American news media just flat out acknowledge that they're not really that interested in portraying the horror of war in the way that some media in Europe or the Arab world have done. It's very upfront. I think the reason is quite simple. The American, especially again, the American television networks have a story that has a nice, clean narrative. It's the story of the great American triumph over the evil dictator Saddam. There's some truth to that. It is a incredible American military machine that can be aimed at a target like that. And it's also true Saddam was a brutal dictator. But that's the story they want, and anything that kind of muddies that story, such as what is the cost to the civilian population, or for that matter, the cost to the Iraqi military. The number of civilian casualties in this war is probably going to be low compared to past conflicts, certainly lower than the Gulf War in 1991. But we tend to forget there were, you know, tens of thousands of Iraqi soldiers, many of them just conscripts, who were really mowed down in this particular war as well. And there's been some good reporting, even in the American press, not just about what that means for the Iraqis, but what it means for the American soldiers who have to participate in this kind of wholesale slaughter. But in general, you won't see that kind of reporting because it does disrupt the story, which at sometimes, I must say, the television coverage almost feels more like a movie than it does news coverage.
The ultimate reality TV show.
That's what it's been called, and it's hard not to be cynical at this point about television news. Clearly, this isn't accidental. They're very aware of what they're doing, and they're very happy with the results, as we might point out, is the American military. The Pentagon loves what's going on television as well, for the obvious reasons that it endorses their view of the war and helps build support with the American public.
What, in your view, is the responsibility of the U.S. media now that the war may very shortly be over? In the aftermath of the conflict, what should American citizens know from the media about the next struggle to rebuild the country and to form a new government, a democratic government, and one that is not a colony, essentially, of the United States?
Well, I wrote a piece that's up on some websites today that makes the obvious point that if the United States is serious about democracy and real self-determination, meaningful democracy, not just the trappings of it, the first thing they should do is leave Iraq and turn over the task of stabilizing the country to a UN peacekeeping force, for the obvious reason that no one outside of the U.S. at least believes that the main motivation for the U.S. war was the liberation of the Iraqi people. Everyone understands this is a war about oil and empire, and the motives of the U.S. matter, and no one is going to trust the legitimacy of an Iraqi government formed under U.S. military occupation. I think that's just kind of almost obvious. The American media, if it were doing its job, would be raising these questions, and it would also be keeping an eye on the degree to which the Americans keep their promises about alleviating the suffering of the Iraqi people. We know that we went through this not so long ago in Afghanistan, where the United States, claiming to bring democracy to Afghanistan, seriously manipulated the Loya-Jirga process to make sure their hand-picked candidate won, and then walked away from the task of rebuilding Afghanistan. It won't play out the same this way, obviously, because there's oil in Iraq, and the United States isn't going to let the country completely fall apart. But the media does have a role at testing whether the United States is making good on those promises it made to the people of Iraq.
That was Robert Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the book, Writing Dissent. For independent reporting on the Iraq War, visit the No War Collective website at www.nowarcollective.com. Trade unionists who organize in Colombia are the target of more violent attacks than in any other nation in the world. 4,000 union members have been murdered in the past 15 years, mostly by the country's right-wing paramilitary organizations. The International Labor Rights Fund, based in Washington, D.C., filed a lawsuit against the Atlanta-based Coca-Cola company, charging that it is complicit in the violence against workers at its bottling plants in Colombia. Last week, a judge in Miami dismissed the lawsuit against Coke, but allowed the continuation of lawsuits against two bottlers in Colombia affiliated with Coca-Cola that plaintiffs allege used paramilitary groups to assassinate and intimidate union leaders. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Terry Collingsworth, executive director of the International Labor Rights Fund and an attorney who was representing seven targeted unionists and the family of one union leader who was killed inside the bottling plant where he worked. Collingsworth discusses the goals of the lawsuit, as well as what his organization and the Bottlers Union is up against in going after Coke.
The most important thing that we are seeking is for Coca-Cola to accept responsibility for its bottlers in Colombia and to change the practices of those bottlers. Right now, we have current evidence that it's an ongoing practice, that the kind of violent activity that resulted in the murder and torture and disappearance of the people I currently represent by paramilitaries, that Coca-Cola bottlers are still doing business with those paramilitaries. They're, in a sense, on their payroll. And so we're demanding that Coca-Cola stop the bottlers from having any participation by violent paramilitaries in their operations. And, of course, to provide damages to the families that have suffered so far. We started this lawsuit almost 2 years ago and also began a parallel campaign to educate Americans and the consumer countries about Coca-Cola's practices. We now have managed to get substantial support from other organizations, other unions. The United Students Against Sweatshops have taken up this issue, and it's growing rapidly because people realize that there's absolutely no excuse for a company as wealthy and prosperous as Coca-Cola to be profiting from murder, torture, and other human rights violations. I think that you'll find that this is going to continue to grow because the general frustrations about the global economy that you've seen in places like Seattle and Washington and Genoa and Ottawa, when the architects of the global economy get together and the students and other activists come to protest, they all are protesting a general frustration with the global economy and the way that it works. We are presenting Coca-Cola as the personification of this global economy, a company that's sitting in Atlanta taking profits in from all over the world, but claiming not to have any responsibility for how the products are made that they are profiting from. One of the themes that people are picking up on is that there's this great incongruity here that we're, as a U.S. government, is launching its so-called war on terror, that companies like Coca-Cola have been engaged in a terrorist activity for years. We've asked the U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft to prosecute Coca-Cola and its bottlers for knowingly participating in terrorist acts because the paramilitaries in Colombia have been designated terrorist organizations by law, and it therefore is unlawful for Coke and its bottlers to provide any support to these companies. So we've given Mr. Ashcroft evidence that Coca-Cola's bottlers are doing business with paramilitaries, and we're wondering why he hasn't taken action yet.
Would you comment on the Judge Martinez, part of his ruling that said that corporations can be sued as individuals under the Tortured Victims Claims Act, and that paramilitary groups operated in a, quote, symbiotic relationship, unquote, with the government of Colombia, thereby satisfying the condition of the act that there be some sort of state action in the abuses?
We are absolutely delighted with Judge Martinez's decision in many respects, particularly two findings that he made under the law. The first is that the Torture Victims Protection Act, which makes it unlawful for an individual to participate in torture or extrajudicial killing, it's a relatively new statute that was passed in 1992 to clarify the Alien Tort Claims Act. And one issue that these corporations, including Coca-Cola, have raised is that since the statute uses the word individual instead of company or some other choice of word, that they were therefore not subject to the law. And that's classic corporate hypocrisy, because corporations demand the rights of individuals in all aspects of life in terms of property rights and rights under the Constitution, but they were trying to use a weasel word here to avoid liability for human rights violations. So the judge clarified that, as in all other walks of life, corporations are treated as individuals under the law and could be held liable under the Torture Victims Protection Act. A second important aspect of his ruling was that he examined the relationship between the paramilitaries in Colombia and the government of Colombia, because part of our burden of proof in an Alien Tort Claims Act case or a Torture Victims Protection Act case is that we have to show that there was some state action, some government complicity in these acts. And here our allegation was that it's the paramilitaries that are doing the murdering and torturing for Coca-Cola, and that because the paramilitaries are allowed to exist in Colombia and in fact are given support by the government of Colombia, that they are in effect a proxy for the government. They're in a symbiotic relationship with the government. And Coke very cynically tried to argue that, no, the paramilitaries have nothing to do with the government. The government in fact doesn't like having the paramilitaries around. And we submitted a couple of, you know, fairly non-controversial reports, including U.S. State Department reports, indicating that anyone who has a pulse in Colombia is going to say that, no, the paramilitaries, in fact, are, in essence, an arm of the government.
That was Terry Collingsworth of the International Labor Rights Fund. For more information, contact the fund at area code 202-347-4100. Or visit their website at www.laborrights.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.